Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel on WAMC. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Joe Donahue. I love that music. It's Los Straitjackets. Our playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. You know, folks, it's time to have a discussion, a serious discussion about the issues confronting us. And I hope you're all gathered around the radio right now because I have quite a panel to introduce to you. Former EPA Regional Administrator, professor at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics. You can hear her a little bit. I think she's on the phone right now. Judith Henk. Hi, Judith.
Good morning. Thrilled to be with you.
Yes, thank you for being here. Partner.
Nothing to talk about.
No. We'll have to make it up. You know, I'm sure there's something, you know, like what we're doing with Wordle or something like that that's more important. Partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman Osterman and Hannah Sienna Freeman Tolbert, right across the table from me.
Hey,
good
hey.
Morning. How are you?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
So glad you are. Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council at the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel. I got it right, right?
You got it perfectly right.
Fantastic. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I haven't had a chance to interact with you yet, but this is great.
I'm excited.
Well, good.
Glad to be here, and I'm excited to get to know you as well.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I don't know that we describe the topics as exciting, but it might raise your temperature. Let's start with the one that has been first and foremost over the last day or so, Jimmy Kimmel's suspension. We start with the Washington Post. Critics accused ABC of bowing to President Donald Trump after suspended Kimmel's show over his comments about the suspect and the Charlie Kirk killing. The right-wing campaign to shut down perceived detractors of the late conservative activist, as I said, Charlie Kirk, reverberated through the entertainment industry Thursday after ABC announced it would indefinitely suspend late-night host Jimmy Kimmel. The news announced late Wednesday spurred an outcry and accusations that ABC had buckled to a censorship campaign targeting one of President Donald Trump's most vocal critics. The network did not give an explanation for suspending Jimmy Kimmel live after the host delivered a monologue Monday accusing the president, quote, the president and his henchmen of trying to capitalize on Kirk's fatal shooting in Utah last week. But Trump and his allies have urged people to drum Kirk's perceived detractors out of their jobs in the aftermath of the activist's death. Now, listeners, please join us, if you like, by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. We've been hearing some of those comments during the pledging that's been going on as Ray and Sarah have raised money for the lockbox. People are concerned. Some are even afraid. We address this topic, of course, on the Media Project this afternoon at 3 p.m., and it is serious. It's almost as if in some ways, I know someone will say we already did, but we've crossed a Rubicon. Since we've got you and we can't see you, Judith Henk, why don't we start with you? How are you feeling at this very moment about this subject?
Well, I feel like the First Amendment is under attack, and this is a clear example of censorship, and it's only going to get worse. I think a lot of this is not about Jimmy Kimmel's humor, but it's about money. Nexstar wants to buy the biggest competitor, and the FCC has to approve or disapprove the $6 billion deal. And Nexstar is affiliated with ABC and Disney. Disney wants to purchase another media company. So I think these companies are just putting money first over the First Amendment. I guess we shouldn't be shocked by that. And I think the response then from the public and from other media celebrities associated with ABC has to be a strategy that pushes back on money. So are people going to start canceling their Disney Plus subscriptions? Will local ABC affiliates start feeling some pressure? The response to this is so much bigger than losing a late night comedian along with Stephen Colbert. The FCC, it will pressure broadcasters to pull the licenses if stations are critical of Trump. And that's not me speculating. That is what Donald Trump and the head of the FCC, Brendan Carr, have said in recent days. The final point I want to make is during Trump's first term, there was this really important little book published by Timothy Snyder called On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And I have in the category of do something, because we're all feeling quite overwhelmed with this moment, I have a friend, Pete, who bought a box of these books and knocked on my door one day and gave me a copy of On Tyranny. And I loved that it was short. And I read it, and it was interesting and informative. But reading it today really hits very hard. And, you know, we have to look at history. And I think our professor, Dr. Karen Riedel, will chime in on this in a much more eloquent way than I. But this book, you know, the chapters are Do Not Obey in Advance, Defend Institutions, Be Wary of Paramilitaries, Look at the Military in the Streets of Major Cities. So I guess the good thing is none of this is, it's unprecedented in the United States, but it's not unprecedented in the world. And it's up to us to stand up, because the big institutions, the ABCs of the world, CBS, law firms, colleges, employers that are firing staff for posting on the tragic death of Charlie Kirk, and we'll get letters on the use of my word tragic. I do think it's tragic. There's no place for political violence, but Charlie Kirk inspired a lot of negative trends in our world. If you happen to be just an individual that posted on this, your job may be at risk. And my final point, I know my real final point is this. Tyrants like Trump, yes, he is a tyrant, they first pick on people that are marginalized that may not have deep pockets to hire lawyers. So I'm reminded of the Palestinian supporter protests, the grad student in Boston who wrote an op-ed. She went to Tufts, and she was literally abducted on the streets of Boston, later released. And I think this is the pattern. The Stephen Millers of the world, because I think this is really mostly directed by him, they go after people who they believe cannot fight back, and then they climb the ladder. And ABC and CBS are not the last rungs on the ladder.
Judith, I want to add to what you just said about the book On Tyranny. Our former CEO, Alan Chartok, interviewed Tim Snyder about that book, and you should be able to find that at WAMC.org if you want to listen to that interview. It's quite something. And then I want to also just add one other quick thing, and that is, you know what, humor has a great tradition in this country. We need the comedians, the satirists, those that can criticize with humor. That takes the autocrat out of and the dictator out of the situation, that puts their feet back on the floor. We need that in this country, and that is part of it, I think, as well. Now, Sienna, you are bucking to get in here. Sienna Freeman Tolbert, please.
Sorry. So I was just going to say, I think Judith made some excellent points. You know, first, we always like to differentiate what's going on right now, right? Because we remember the quote-unquote cancel culture. And what you were seeing was individuals in our society putting pressures on corporations to take actions, right, with our wallets. And that's what we were doing. And the difference here is, obviously, is that the government's putting that pressure on. And over the last few months, just been a few months, we've seen how they've tried to make this structure. So it started with the universities and in my field and with the immigrants, right? What can someone who's here on a non-immigrant visa say and not say? And so we saw that political speech and how that's curtailed and how that's questioned. But I thought it was so important to bring this up is earlier this week, one of the representatives Brian Mass seek to allow. So what we started with, right, is immigrants being restricted free speech. Now you see corporations like Paramount and ABC, they're beholden to the government because they want to get some approval, FCC approval,
CBS.
Right? CBS. So you see all that. Now, I think what you're seeing is the government say, how do we get the individuals? And we're all like, you can't get us. We have free speech. Well, there was recently legislation proposed where they would not allow passports to U.S. citizens to be issued if you gave material support to a designated terrorist group. They didn't say domestic. They didn't say international. They said designated terrorist group. What does that mean? Now they're trying to get to the U.S. citizen speech.
And we have on our topic list today Antifa.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Them trying to designate exactly. The terrorist group.
Exactly. And so you see how they're trying to get to the individuals now and what they're saying. And it's very structured and it's very scary.
It certainly is. It's chilling. And when these major networks that have the money to fight, don't let them fool you otherwise. Oh, we got this big deal. But they still have the money to fight it. Acquiesce and self-censor. We're on the wrong slippery slope. Karen Riedel, please weigh in.
And so many interesting thoughts were already made, and I don't really know what else to add other than the fact that I was really shook up on Wednesday night, right before I went to bed early. I'm an early bed, as my family will attest to. I go to bed early, but in the last 9 months, it's been difficult because we've seen every step taken towards becoming more of an authoritarian state. And I'm going to add another book on your list to read, almost as short as Snyder's book on tyranny. By Ziblatt and Levitsky, two Harvard scholars, who published a book in 2018 titled How Democracies Die, which gives us a wonderfully effective overview of the course of history across the world on the steps that we need to be aware of to ensure that a democracy does not turn authoritarian. Excellent book. Please put it on your list of books to read. And so we've seen every step followed, but somehow the pulling of the Kimmel show shook me more than anything else, and I've been trying to figure out why that is the case. And much of what Judith and Sienna mentioned is part of the explanation, the speed in which this happened. We knew it was going to happen. We knew this was the plan of the administration. We knew that President Trump takes the humor very personally. I mean, he's very open about it as compared to the head of the FCC, Carr, who still kind of like tries to find some logic in the behavior. But President Trump is very open about it. I don't like what they say about me, and I want them off the air. But the speed in which this has happened was frightening. The fact that NextCar never pushed back. The fact that we still, I think, have not heard from Kimmel, right? We have still not heard from Kimmel. And the announcement immediately after, we're going to find you. We're going to find if you said something against Charlie Kirk. And please, if you're a neighbor, if you're a family member, if you're a fellow employee has said anything, let us know so we can get to them. This is frightening. And I think everyone here, I suspect, and probably most of our listeners, at least for a split second, stopped and wondered, did I say something that could get me into trouble? I sure did, because I was here on Monday and I spoke openly about the way I feel. And I sure, as I was speaking, felt that intimidation, and it kept me up the night after. And I think that is what the change is. And now, one more thing that I'd like to say, both Judith and Sienna mentioned the need for the general public to get involved. And we really haven't. Did you see the demonstrations in London? That was extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Did you hear the journalists, how they pose questions to Trump that we don't hear here anymore? They are not intimidated. We are. And in addition to that, so the numerous factors I was thinking about, and I wonder, I would like to hear from Judith and Sienna, because to me, this is a daily question that I ask myself. Where is the public? Why are we so very quiet? Right.
You know, I'm sorry. I was going to say, like, because you got me. Now I'm all going. And I was just saying, like, you know where the public is. They're hiding from the National Guard that is on their streets. Mm-hmm. We have ICE agents that are on the street picking up people that just because they look different and maybe you don't have your passport on you, you might get picked up. You don't know. It's very intimidating right now in America. I mean, even for individuals that may look like they're an immigrant or what have you. Just imagine you want to speak out against something. Someone, some ICE officer picks you up to go verify your status, right? Because you were speaking out. And then they release you after you've been detained for 4 to 5 business days in some place where where our legislators can't get into. It is a scary time. And then the DOJ is coming after you, so you know you can't go to them for protection. It's scary times for Americans.
It is scary. But in addition to that, who does not have friends who have said to you, I am not listening to news anymore. It makes me anxious.
There you are.
I can't hear it. I'm looking away because it doesn't make me feel good. Well, guess what? You got to get your head out of the sand again. If you haven't done over the last 9 months, this is the time. You got to get your head out of the sand, because these corporations, the media conglomerates who are, and I don't blame them. They're about money. They want to make these mergers. They want to get the FCC to agree to having an audience that's more than 40%, et cetera, et cetera. This is a business. I do not blame them.
But
I do feel that if we don't know what's going on, then we cannot put pressure on them to do the right thing.
Well, intimidation and fear works. It gets people to straighten up and fly right. And before we go any further, we're flying with this topic for sure. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Let's go.
You heard them. Let's go. It's Los Straitjackets, our playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Joe Donahue today. An amazing panel, already an amazing discussion. You can join us by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. Now from Polly, a note for the panel. Project 25 made a deal with Trump. They will enable his use of the government to exact revenge on his real and perceived enemies. In return, he has placed their operatives in control of government agencies. Time for a people's revolution. Well, we keep hearing about Project 2025, and for the most part, it seems like they're following that. Judith?
Yeah, they sure are. And Russell Vogt, or however you say the gentleman's name. He has his hands on the controls in the federal government. I guess the helpful thing is if we want a preview of what's coming next, just read that dreadful document. I certainly read the environmental section, and they're going through their checklist of rolling back environmental protections. I want to go back to what Professor Riedel said. I think we are at an inflection point, and we all have friends and relatives who we love who've said to us, I just can't watch the news anymore, and it's because it's too painful. Our democracy is sunsetting before our eyes. And I get it. You know, I don't watch as much news as I used to, but this is a moment where we all need to be very well informed, pick our news sources carefully, like WAMC, and get involved. There's this great scene in the movie Moonstruck. Remember when Cher slaps Nicolas Cage and says, snap out of it? Mm-hmm. This is our Moonstruck moment. People who are just too demoralized by following the news, I'm sorry. You got to get in the arena. You know, yes, you have to protect yourself so you're not clinically depressed all the time, but we need people to stand up. And it's scary, but you know what's scarier? If you are an immigrant in this country and you're walking down the street and you get disappeared, even if it is high profile, I'm remembering all of the media coverage of the Columbia University grad student Mahmoud Kahil, who, remember, was snatched from his apartment building lobby and sent to an ICE jail in Louisiana. Very high profile, lots of public support. He is now being deported because they claim he made a mistake on his green card. So even when, you know, there is visibility on these issues, Stephen Miller in the White House is not going to back down. So with this ABC situation, I was watching my email yesterday thinking, when are we all going to show up at the local ABC affiliate in peaceful protest? I don't think anything is planned. So let's just go. Let's go to the local ABC affiliate, and even if it's just you and your best friend from college, stand there with a sign and show up every day. I mean, this is the time. So many Americans have a short attention span, but they're paying attention to Jimmy Kimmel. Not that he was so popular. I don't think he was as big as Colbert. But this is just such a clear example of trampling First Amendment rights. I think this is going to stay with people for a while.
Well, Judith, Karen, Sienna, what about those that think, and we've heard this before, it can't happen here. This is America. I've heard this from people. You know, they stop panicking. This isn't going to happen. You know, this is nothing like what we're seeing or what we saw in Germany or any other place. This is America. You know, there are people that truly believe this and that we're overreacting.
Yeah, no, they do. It is nothing unusual. I think that was the same in Hungary, and it may have been the same in Turkey. It certainly was the case in Germany, but especially in the United States, where people from a very early age are told that this is a special country. It is a unique country. It is the oldest democracy. It has the shortest written, but a constitution that has been in place for some 250 years. It always has pulled back, and these are the ideas and the stories with which our kids are raised, and it's very difficult to break out of this mindset. I fully understand it, but I do think I see more and more people who are becoming aware that this is a very real risk. And so I'm hopeful that we're breaking out of this mindset, because it truly creates barriers to pushing back, to try to fight what's clearly happening, right?
Yeah. So as I think about this, I think more and more about the fact that is the Trump administration's, whatever they call themselves doing right now, is it even effective? And what I mean by that is they're threatening to take away licenses from local stations and what have you, but majority of the population, we get our news from social media. We listen to podcasters who are individual. We listen to people who are independent. And so how much does this affect us? And I'm like, strategically, I'm thinking, I can't tell you like how often young people watch the local news, where the FCC has some control on that, right? And which is why it's concerning about what's happening with TikTok, right? Because now they're trying to get their fingers there and around social media so they can have some control. But on one hand, I'm like, how much impact does the FCC have in terms of getting the message out? You can't get a high schooler to watch a whole episode of the local news. Just they won't. They, you know, it's hard unless it's an assignment. I mean, it's just. Jimmy Kimmel was great, I guess, but we only watched him in clips. You know, it's not often that you can do that. And for the most part, what he said, the FCC chairman was saying that the reason why these networks should be regulated because it's in the public interest, because they're public stations, right? But how often are we watching public stations? What is everyone watching? Netflix and Disney, Disney asterisk, we'll see. But I'm just saying there's different mediums now. And so how do they account for that? And so I think about that, and it kind of gives me, I always like to give a little bit of hope, audacity to hope, if I will. because in those other countries where you had this type of oppressions and dictatorships in Africa and things like that, people were able to rise up through social media and through that sharing of information. It's not a time where we share all our information does not come from the news anymore, unfortunately. We're all now sitting down, and so it's harder, what I'm saying, for the government to control that.
So a Russian bot will become our president?
Probably.
No, but I think this
What's the bot called on Twitter? I forget what he's called. Grok.
Grok, that's it.
I think that's a really important point, right? It's like there are not being silenced. There are other outlets, and they may be even more effective in many ways. They may reach a crowd that doesn't usually listen to or doesn't watch TV anymore. But I'm going to pick up on that. It's a conversation that Sienna and I had before the show started as well. It's like, and to continue my thought process, and why is it that people are not standing up? Why don't we see more people out in the street? And at the heart of that is the fact that we don't agree on what is news anymore, right? It's like, on a regular basis, I come to class and ask my students, what is the news that you heard yesterday? And only to remind myself that my students, it's not just that they don't listen to the same medium. It's like they don't agree with me what the news are. A day before Charlie Kirk's shooting, there were shootings in Minnesota. I came into the classroom and I was like, what are the news you heard? And in a classroom of 32 students, I had three students who had known about the shootings. So it's at the heart of this is the fact that we don't even agree anymore what the news are.
And the news is so divided and seen and labeled partisan, even when they're legitimate news organizations trying to do the journalism of verification. We can't even see them as legit. So we're in a real difficult spot when it comes to the demonization of journalism and all these new forms of information that have come about that muddy the waters. They don't clear. It's like, you know, the needle in the proverbial haystack. We're not going to be able to get, we're getting further and further from finding truth.
And of course, and while I would like to talk a little bit about this whole debate of First Amendment, because I find it fascinating how it's grown as a concept without further explanation of what it actually means, what the significance is to society, what are the considerations, certainly, but... and I lost my train of thought, but it was an important one, so I'll get back to it. But I would like to talk about the First Amendment and the way it's been discussed, the way it's been thrown out, and the way it's been weaponized.
And the way it's been protected, right, by the Supreme Court. Like, so technically the FCC is only supposed to sanction for obscenities, indecency, and profanity. That's the three things that they're watching when they're, you know, going over. And the U.S. Supreme Court, just in 2024, unanimous, they ruled that regulators cannot pressure private firms to blacklist a speaker for its viewpoint. And so they talked about this. I think this is one of the issues. And specifically, Chief Justice Roberts has written really, really scathing decisions on this, where he stands for the First Amendment. So it's going to be interesting to see where it goes if it gets to the court. But I don't think, oh gosh, I'm putting my hope in my court again. I don't think we lose on this issue is what I'm saying.
What I'm worried about is New York Times versus Sullivan. He's now suing the New York Times for $15 billion. He used the phrase actual malice. Now, look, what he wants to do is to be able to go after public officials who say anything bad about him. And if you don't, and I don't know where the Supreme Court is on this, but it probably ain't good. So if he gets this in a court and they keep challenging it all the way, we talked about it on the Media Project. What happens to New York Times versus Sullivan?
Well, I think that's a very frivolous lawsuit against the New York Times and Trump. And
Judge shopping.
Yeah, they're. I mean, this one is a bridge too far. They're not going to succeed. And in fact, I think this is a good time to promote New York Times reporter Suzanne Craig's book about Trump, which just came out in paperback this week. And it, she's one of the stellar Times reporters who's been named in the lawsuit. But I have a different concern. Of course, the lawsuits against the New York Times and the actions of both CBS and ABC are concerning. But I think the bigger issue are things that we're not going to see. And it's this whole structure of do not obey in advance. I think fear has infiltrated many workplaces, college campuses, where, you know, they're supposed to be areas of you know, thoughtful debate on not just both sides, like hundreds of different sides. I mean, there's a chilling effect on big college campuses, college presidents being fired or resigning almost weekly. I mean, that pervasive erosion of democratic principles is, I think, going to be the real long-term damage here.
Judith,
this administration.
Yeah, we'll just stop it there. We've reached the end of our time. We have to take a little breaklet. We're going to go over to Sarah and Madeline for some more Lockbox, and we hope you'll be with us. You hear the issues, folks. You heard what Judith and Sienna and Professor Reed said. It's time for us to stand up now. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel on WAMC. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Joe Donahue today. That music, Los Straitjackets, the list, playlist that is, online at wamc.org/roundtable. We are here with former EPA regional administrator, professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and professor of government at Dutchess Community College and president of World Affairs Council, the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel. Now, folks, we have another topic. Remember, panel at WAMC.org. We need to hear from more of you this morning. This is a Judith special topic, folks, and I think it should be the topic most days of the week. The Trump administration is dismantling climate politics. Once, the Trump administration merely downplayed the threat of global warming. Now it flatly denies the science. This from the New York Times, Adam Kushner. There is stronger evidence than ever that greenhouse gases are bad for us, the nation's leading scientific advisory board said yesterday. Yet President Trump has proposed to cancel the government's 16-year-old finding that carbon dioxide emissions endanger public health. Doing so would mean the Environmental Protection Agency would no longer limit emissions from cars or power plants. The Trump administration once merely downplayed the threat. Now it flatly denies the overwhelming scientific evidence of climate change. And here's a list of the most important climate decisions from Trump's second term: ending climate protections, dismantling climate science, and a war on wind and solar. Obviously, Judith, this is dear to your heart, as it is to many of us. Let's hear what you're thinking.
Well, this is incredibly serious. And not having the EPA regulate greenhouse gas emissions will have devastating impacts on public health, on the environment, on our economy. The climate change crisis is here. There's no question. I just kind of think, you know, forget reading long, detailed scientific papers. Just think of your own life, the extreme weather, the devastating wildfires up in Canada with the smoke affecting us in the Northeast. We've got melting glaciers that are making sea level rise worse. We have disappearing coral reefs, if anyone enjoys coral reefs in warmer weather. Local tick infestation is on the increase. So you've got to be really careful with deer ticks and Lyme disease. And what's so important is that greenhouse gases that are emitted into the air today last for decades. So even if a new administration came in and they reversed course, all of the pollution that is lingering in our atmosphere is going to be there for decades. It's like trying to turn a giant cruise ship. It doesn't happen suddenly. In terms of my former workplace, Environmental Protection Agency, they, you know, historically have done really important work, not just on regulating greenhouse gases, but keeping track. You know, if you can't measure, you can't take effective action. And so scientists have been fired left and right. Databases and regulations that require companies to report, just report what their greenhouse gas emissions are. That has been taken down. This is really a war on science, not just at the EPA, but other federal agencies like NOAA, like NASA. So, you know, this doesn't get the daily attention, Dave. I appreciate you mentioning that, that it needs, but it is really going to harm all of us. The warmest years on record have all been since a decade ago. So like right now I'm going to say once the data comes in, if we still have the data, 2025 will be the warmest year on record. And then next year I'm going to say 2026 is the warmest year on record. I mean, this is quite serious. And the people who are hurt the most are those with the least resources. I teach a class on plastic pollution, and we cover plastics and climate change because plastics is plan B for the fossil fuel industry. And this week we talked about, remember, I think it was three summers ago, half of Pakistan was underwater with intense flooding, which can be linked somewhat to climate change. And Pakistan's climate minister remarked that they only emit less than 1% of the world's greenhouse gases, and yet half of their country was underwater. So it's serious. The states can take action, and unfortunately, Governor Kathy Hochul is walking in the wrong direction on climate change issues. New York State has a climate goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The governor has said that the state is unlikely to meet the climate goals. And so what is she recommending? Relaxing the goals. You know, a true leader would say this is not easy. Transforming the way we generate electricity and the way we transport ourselves in cars and trucks and trains. So what we're going to do is we're going to double down. We're going to put more resources into the climate crisis because we remember Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Irene. But instead, oddly, the governor has said we're not going to meet the climate goals, so we're going to partially give up. And, you know, an illustration of that is she's now promoting two fracked gas pipelines in New York, one called the NESE pipeline, which New York State Department of Environmental Conservation rejected a few years ago because of environmental impacts. And the governor is now leading the charge to get two new fracked gas pipelines approved in New York. So, you know, just at the moment that we need states to stand up, Governor Hochul is not standing up to the Trump administration on climate change. Final point in the category of there is something we can do, I want to invite everyone to a really amazing event happening in Albany this Sunday afternoon. Some of your listeners may know the name Bill McKibben, an incredible climate change leader with the organization Third Act, of which there's a chapter in upstate New York. All across the country this Sunday, in many, many different communities, is a Sunday event. It's a little confusing. It's Sunday on Sunday, so don't mess it up. You can show up at the Empire State Plaza this Sunday from 12 noon to 4. Go to the base of the egg. So it's underneath the egg. You can't miss the egg, but it's indoors on the concourse. And there are probably 30 or 40 different groups and renewable energy companies that will have tables, wonderful speakers, wonderful music, an art display involving wool. And I'll be doing a workshop at 12:30 talking about my new book, The Problem with Plastic, which you can pre-order from the New Press or wherever you buy books. So there is a series of really short half-hour workshops interspersed in the day. And for people who care about the climate crisis, solar is definitely a response to the climate crisis. It's something you can do at your own business, your own home, and you will, in a really fun, joyful way, learn everything you might want to know about solar this Sunday at the Sunday events at the Empire State Plaza.
Judith, I want to just follow up with you because you talked about Governor Kathy Hochul, and she's also embraced nuclear. Where are you on that?
Yes. Oh, I personally think nuclear is a huge mistake. It took decades to get the Indian Point power plant closed down in Westchester County. And, you know, every few years it's like, oh, it's not the old nuclear, it's the new nuclear. Well, the new nuclear still generates a huge amount of radioactive waste, is very, very expensive, will not get built without taxpayer subsidies. And I think there are still real safety concerns. I'm disappointed that the governor is pushing nuclear. I think part of this is to power data centers, and New York needs to know that the governor has embraced nuclear, is trying to walk back some of the state's climate goals. It just doesn't make sense, especially seeing the federal government abandoned important work on climate change. So not a lot of people know that the governor is actively promoting nuclear. I think fiscal conservatives particularly should pay attention to this because there's going to be the need for huge public subsidies, which the Trump administration will happily provide. And it's disappointing that the governor is going in this direction, and I hope she changes course.
I was going to say, Judith, just to add on to what you're saying, what I'm seeing in my field is a lot of the concern is about the research. You talk about not collecting the data, but research not being funded. Specifically for a lot of my researchers here who are foreign nationals, now there was something that's called the National Interest Waiver, where you were able to get a green card and self-petition if you were doing something in the U.S. national interest. And one of those things was studying, researching climate change in the country.
Yeah.
And that's been, you know, that's no longer a priority among this new administration. And so these individuals cannot even remain to continue to study climate change here in the U.S. So it's all these little things that they've taken away that impact the long-term development in that climate field.
Yeah, I have heard this from professors. This is a huge brain drain that is going to put the U.S. in a less competitive position. The other thing is some elected officials say we need an all-of-the-above energy policy, which is fossil fuels and nuclear and renewable energy. I certainly disagree with that, especially since renewables are cheaper than fossil fuels today. But what I'm concerned about with the Trump administration is they are killing offshore wind projects.
Mm-hmm. One that was almost completed.
Yeah, 80% complete, called Revolution Wind in Rhode Island. And there's also been media reports that one reason that Governor Hochul may be pushing fracked gas pipelines is because she called President Trump expressing concern that he was trying to cancel an offshore wind project in Long Island. I appreciate her weighing in to try to protect that offshore wind project in Long Island, but you don't make a deal with the devil. Back off on killing offshore wind, and now we're going to fast track all the permitting on fracked gas pipelines. That's just not a good deal. So what's sort of puzzling is I know that Trump opposed an offshore wind project in Scotland near one of his golf courses. And so he's been on the rampage opposing wind, which he calls windmills. But it doesn't make any sense to be canceling wind and solar and geothermal and getting rid of tax credits for electric vehicles if indeed you say you want an all-of-the-above energy policy.
Mm. Well, we're
going to talk about all of that this Sunday at Sundays from noon to 4 in Albany.
To me, that's so interesting because the company that I get the most emails from about solar is Tesla. Like, that's who email me the most frequently, and I'm always... So it's always just an interesting dichotomy to me. Like, so do you Are you buddies with him and support his industry, or are you not buddies with him? Did they break up?
They broke up.
Yeah, they broke up. They were in front of.
Oh, okay.
They were standing in front of a Tesla at one point, and yeah. Trump was raving about it. But then they broke up, and so that's
oh, not together.
That's not working out.
I thought they still talked.
Well, listen.
It seems like American public policy is these days based on Donald Trump's dysfunctional personal relationships with people.
Yeah. Well. Let's continue our non-dysfunctional conversation about these subjects with a panel listener. Leonard writes, "Dear panel, Republicans came up with the term climate change as a way of distracting us from the reality of global warming. A major source of global warming is the military. The environmental movement needs to join with our peace movement to reverse Trump's militarism and policed state agenda." We've got a little under 3 minutes. Any thoughts on that letter?
Well, I agree with part of it. I mean, the military is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions, but it's no longer factually accurate to refer to global warming because it's so much more than warming. It's violent weather, for instance. Mm-hmm. You'll notice that
more moisture.
Large amounts of rain come down during shorter periods of time. So that's why it's accurate to call it climate change and not global warming.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I noticed firsthand when the deniers were coming out was just look at your bird books and you see that they already adjusted. This is way mm-hmm. back now. The bird patterns, where they were migrating to and where they're migrating from. So you start and not only that, but the plants and how plants grow and what are growing in what zones. So, you know,
right.
It's pretty obvious when you look at it from that perspective that it's happening.
And we've known about it for decades. I mean, I remember speaking with Bill McKibben in front of the United Nations about, it was before my son was born, so it's over 37 years ago. And I remember going to the New York State Museum and remember microfiche,
yep.
pulling out articles to get myself better informed on climate change. And there was Bill and I and maybe three reporters and people from Tuvalu, an island nation that is rapidly going underwater. Mm. And everything that McKibben and the island nations said over 37 years ago is just even more urgent today.
Yeah. Well, you don't need microfiche today, thank goodness, to inform
yes,
yourself. You can just tune in to WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We're really trying to do our best to inform you about the important issues and more that affect you not only in the Northeast, but in the world. And to that end, we need to keep the radio station alive, keep it going. And that, unfortunately, in our modern society requires dough. You know, money, the greenbacks, we got to put them in the lockbox. We got to push them up. We're going to keep this station growing and thriving for years to come through the people power. That's it, you listeners. We can't tell you how much we appreciate you, and yet we're going to do it again right now. That's Sarah and Madeline. Ten 31 on a Friday. Boy, I feel like I should be surfing to that song somewhere, right? On a beach? Yeah, that's good. That's Los Straitjackets, and it's posted online, that playlist, at WAMC.org/roundtable. I'm David Gustina, in for Joe Donahue today. And we're with Judith Enck and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert and Dr. Karen Riedel talking about the issues of the day. And they're not that fun to talk about. Hey, what do you say we bring back rubella and mumps now? No, that's not the number. I'm not supposed to give the number. All right. Well, listen, I think you probably guessed where we're going here. This is from the Washington Post. CDC advisors make their first childhood vaccine edit. Oh, by the way, listeners, panel at WAMC.org is how to get in touch with us. You may want to react to this story. Federal vaccine advisors voted Thursday to roll back a childhood vaccine recommendation, marking the first change to the routine immunization schedule under Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is helming a broad review of vaccines he has maligned for years. In an 8-3 vote, with one member abstaining. Wow. The 12-member Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, handpicked by Kennedy, recommended skipping a combination measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox vaccine given to about 15% of children receiving their first dose of vaccination for those diseases until the child is at least four. The combination vaccine, which is different from the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine that children more commonly receive, has typically been administered to children between 12 and 15 months of age. The panel recommended that children under four get separate vaccines, ones against measles, mumps, rubella, and another for chicken pox. The recommendation now goes to the acting head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who will decide whether to make it the official government recommendation. Well, who wants to start?
I'll start.
Sienna.
I feel very passionate about this because I think what I was saying is, on one hand, we have this big, beautiful act, which is going to lead to almost 4.8 million people losing coverage by 2034. It eliminates certain eligibility for some immigrant groups, such as refugees and asylees. So all these people are going to be losing their access to health care at the same time that our access to health care is becoming more difficult. Because now they're saying that in order to, for at least the hepatitis B one, in order to, they're delaying the hepatitis B for infants now under the assumption that the mother has been screened. And what if the mother has not been screened? That's why they were doing it earlier. And it's just, it feels like they're taking away both hands. They're making it harder for everyone.
Didn't your mother ever say, don't assume? Sorry.
Threw me off in my tangent. But it's just, it's really, really hard as a mother to figure out what you need to do for your children, what they need. And it is so important to be able to depend on the CDC or your government to have certain things in line that they've cleared, that you know they've read through all the reports and they decided this is the best course of action. To be able to rely on that is so important when you're dealing with so many different other factors in life, especially now when people are trying to figure out how they can eat every day and groceries are expensive. Now they have to think about the fact that I have to get this separate measles vaccine for my child. Then I need to find time to schedule another appointment to go back and get the second part of that vaccination. You know how hard it is to get just logistics to get an appointment once a year to go in for your child to get their shots and to get them out of school, to take time off of work. Just the logistics to it. It's just making it harder to get these vaccinations, harder for everyone to be covered. And it's terribly frustrating seeing this when it's also coupled with the fact that they're rolling back funding of things like Medicaid, where people would have access to medical care and other provisions in the ACA.
And it's just, once again, yet another example of how these cuts that seemingly affect the most vulnerable sectors in society aren't just going to affect those people. It's not just going to affect immigrants, for example. Infectious diseases are going to affect us all.
All of us.
It's going to affect us all. They don't stick with the immigrant community. They don't stay in the states that are maybe more lax about it. We will all be affected. And I was just reminded of the 2019 measles outbreak in Brooklyn, the largest in decades in the United States. Now, it may be your choice to vaccinate your child or not, but those who were really affected were, for example, pregnant women who had been late with renewing the MMR shot and were deeply worried about the way it would affect their unborn child, for example. Can I actually just add on to this? Because from the sounds of it, and again, I'm no expert in that regard at all, but from the sounds of it, the actual impact, the initial impact on our access to vaccines for our children is not going to be limited. But what I found really fascinating is that the background story to the panel, because half of the panel apparently was just picked this week. And you could see that in the way they examined and discussed the matters at hand. Many of them didn't even know what the impact of the vaccine was. They had no data in front of them. They had to be told what the rules are. And based on that, what I would call no knowledge, they came to a conclusion. I think they didn't make it to hepatitis B.
They didn't make it yet. It's coming out today it's happening today.
They were too busy with the MMR.
Well, just to remind everybody, Kennedy fired every member of the vaccine panel in June. And most of his replacements have criticized coronavirus vaccine policies. This is from the Washington Post. Former CDC Director Susan Menares, who we witnessed testifying, said she was fired after refusing to rubber stamp recommendations from the reformulated committee, and several top vaccine leaders resigned in protest. The idea that Americans' health is being endangered by the very place we relied on that's probably more frightening than anything else we talked about today, because by those actions, any one of us is at risk, and we don't know. We just don't know when or where or how that might happen. And how many people did we witness during the coronavirus die?
And here comes the lawyer with her briefcase. But eventually, is this going to lead to lawsuits? I mean, I care more about what's happening with the public health because that's more immediate. But this is going to lead to lawsuits. We're going to pull those minutes and those records to see how in-depth they looked at, what reports they looked at, who did they listen to. And if they did something that was not in the public interest and we can prove it, it's going to lead to some legal lawsuits.
Judith?
Well, the CDC is a mess. I mean, Bobby Kennedy Jr. is a washed-up Clean Water Act lawyer who is now making public policy not based on science. And what's really unfortunate is, yeah, there's a 12-member advisory committee, but he has stacked the deck and appointed people who he has pre-selected, who he thinks agrees with him. Reasonable people can debate whether you wait till age 4 on some of these vaccines, whether you spread them out, if you can, as mentioned, if you can actually get the appointment. But the problem is this CDC has zero credibility. They are not making decisions based on sound science. You know, even Trump was questioning what was going on in Florida with DeSantis' policy on vaccines. But Trump, you know, Trump just gets quick clips on Fox News and doesn't follow up even when he has concerns. But this is a very serious situation. It will affect herd immunity. I think all we can do is listen to our own doctors and listen to medical associations. American Academy of Pediatrics is a much better source of guidance for parents than the CDC. And it's just... it's just tragic. There's going to be additional illness, infectious disease, death, because Bobby Kennedy doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, and you mentioned Florida, which is a real problem. Here in the Northeast, we've seen states like New York and Massachusetts saying, no, we're going to make sure you can get the shots you need when you need them. And, you know, this is where we're hopefully... I shouldn't say hopefully. I said this is where we should be worrying, in my opinion, about what we were told when the coronavirus hit. It's not if, but when another pandemic hits. Mm-hmm. And we're not prepared for that, I can only imagine, at this point.
And vaccination shouldn't be something for only the privileged can get, right? And that's what it starts happening. If insurance doesn't cover it because the CDC doesn't recommend it, then only certain people can afford to have vaccinations. Only certain people have these. And that's a terrible way to function in our society. Go ahead, Judith. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. The three senior people at CDC who either were fired or resigned out of protest, and Susan Manares, by the way, was a recent Trump appointee, and she didn't last more than a month. They have all said publicly that the U.S. is woefully unprepared for any future infectious disease outbreak. And we certainly saw that in Texas with the measles outbreak, where it was largely unvaccinated kids. Kids, by the way, who are not making these decisions, but their poorly informed parents are. So this is, you know, this is quite a serious situation. And we also appreciate, I also appreciate the West Coast governors and the Northeast governors coming together to make sure that we all have access to COVID vaccines, which is going to be really, really important, particularly this winter, if we want to avoid another shutdown and avoid just getting COVID, which is, you know, pretty brutal if you've had it, and concerns about long COVID. But are we living in a world now where you only get protection from COVID if you live in a state where the governor is making decisions on health policy based on science rather than political ideology. I mean, it's, and again, it's the...
Yes.
Yeah, we are. And the families in the states that don't have informed health departments are going to suffer.
You are listening to the Roundtable panel on WAMC. That was Judith Enck. We've been hearing from Dr. Karen Riedel and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. I'm David Gustina, in for Joe Donahue today. Email us at panel@wamc.org. Share your thoughts about these important subjects. And remember, we're trying to also put some money in that lockbox, wamc.org. Let's take a mini break, and we'll be right back. Come on, everybody. Let's get into it here. It's the Los Straitjackets. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Yeah, I could listen to that instead for the next 15 minutes, but we've got some work to do. You would? Oh, yeah, he would. See, Mike Bowen, he's always there for me when I need him. And so are the listeners to this radio station. We can't thank everyone enough so far who's pledged in the lockbox. With us this morning, Dr. Karen Riedel, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Judith Enck. Let's do a topic switch, and this one sort of heading back toward where we were earlier this morning, but a different subject. Can Trump actually designate Antifa, or Antifa, or however you say it, a terrorist group? The first of all, I love that the New York Times, the article I'm looking at here, has some questions over each paragraph, and one of them is Antifa actually an organization? One word, no.
No.
So well, you know, this amorphous thing. How do you designate it anything? Then you can just pick any individuals you find and say you're part of that group.
Exactly.
Sienna?
I mean, oh,
yes.
Nodding my head.
Yes. Thank you for agreeing with me. Say something.
No, I completely agree. I think it's the fact that you are not allowed to have domestic terrorist groups, right? Like, that's part of the protection. That's part of the free speech. And that goes back to when I was looking into this and reading more about it. That's when I got onto my Chief Justice Roberts spiel, because I wanted to see how often he's protected this, because my main thing is, will the Supreme Court protect free speech at the end of the day when it comes to this? And it seems like this is something, and the article we were reading mentioned that he'd protected it in the past, and so that's why I went back and did some other Roberts free speech record, where he's repeatedly protected it in 2010 when he struck down a ban on animal cruelty language, in 2011 when he upheld the Westboro Baptist protest. At funerals, he upheld it in 2014 when he invalidated abortion clinic buffer zones. He's upheld it. He continues to uphold it. He says, end quote, however ugly, it is entitled to the highest protection. So I just think that this is something where Trump will not get far on at all. This is something where the court, at best, he might get a little Thomas, maybe a little Alito, but I think it's going
to... Yeah, I'll take a little Thomas, a little Alito.
But I just think that Roberts would not be able, with his record and the precedent as it shows legally, that he would not uphold this. And then what I found very interesting was, I was like, okay, domestic terrorism is not allowed.
That's right.
But what we've heard recently, especially in our immigration world, is, you know, foreign terrorist groups like drug cartels are foreign terrorist groups now. And I was looking into that. I was like, let me just see what's happening and what's the global response. And what I saw was recently the Mexican president, she was pointing out that you're calling our drug cartels, and she's referring to the U.S. She's saying, you're saying that it's a terrorist group, but you fund, and quote, 74% of the weapons that these groups use, the U.S. And so she was saying what they're thinking about doing is they need tighter controls, but she was talking about whether or not they could sue or some kind of lawsuit against the U.S. for funding these drug cartels that they call foreign domestic terrorists. So it was such an interesting cycle to watch and see what's happening. And like the input, like how do these foreign domestic groups, how are they formed and who funds them, who gives them material support, as they say, as Trump was saying, anyone that gives material support to domestic terrorism, terrorists would be in trouble. But in all actuality, it's the U.S. companies that are funding the foreign, giving material support to foreign terrorist organizations. Sorry.
So is this empty rhetoric by Trump?
Yes.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. I don't think it's empty rhetoric. I mean, rhetoric matters. Right?
Yeah.
The messages that are sent matter, and as we can see. Right? I mean, it's like the division in the country and the rise in violence, the rise in political violence is very obvious. And this kind of language, this kind of rhetoric feeds into it. But, you know, it raises that question that I grapple with always, the differentiation between free speech and hate speech, and especially over the last few days, where it was just like the terms free speech and hate speech were thrown about without further explanation. I'm always reminded of one of my favorite quotes that I like to share with my students by Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, who said that our liberties are tested based on the actions of not very nice people. Now, the reason why I've always been fascinated with hate speech, not just specifically, but in terms of like the significance to our political system, is because did you know that hate speech is protected only in the United States? There is no other democracy in the world where hate speech is protected. And that tells me so much about the political culture here in the United States. And I've been grappling with that because I do, as someone who hasn't grown up here, I do question, is it necessary? Freedom of speech, without a doubt, no democracy can function without our right to criticize the government and government policies. That's what freedom of speech is about. But so why is hate speech protected? Why is it so important here in this particular country, unlike in other democracies, to take it a step further and say, we will also protect the worst, right? The worst kind of viewpoints that most of us find upsetting. Why is it so important? I have thoughts, but I would like to hear Sienna's thoughts on that as a lawyer.
Good luck, Sienna. We're waiting.
I mean, here we go.
And let me just say, and I'll give you a moment to breathe. I've had mixed feelings about it. At this point, seeing how speech has been weaponized, I actually err on the side of saying, no, let's protect it on both sides, to just protect us from having the leadership misuse speech against us, right? It's like, but it's a fascinating question. Why is it the case that here we are the only country that actually protects hate
speech?
But
this is case in point why it's so important right now that we don't do protect hate speech,
yes,
right? Because what is hate speech is objective. And I think that's the concern. And that's when I said that I think this is just rhetoric, because I think in practice it fails, right? Who do you send? You're sending the FBI after somebody because they put something up in terms of Antifa for a while was Black Lives Matter. So if someone put that out on their lawn, we have FBI standing out to arrest them because they spoke, because they think they're part of Antifa, because maybe they sent money to a Black Lives Matter organization. Is that material support? What is material support? You have to define it. And so I just think that's why I think it's just rhetoric, because in practice, and that's why I think I always remind people a lot, is a lot of the things he does, especially via executive order, sometimes it is effective, but other times it's just like, how does this work logistically? Like, my brain always goes logistically. How do we work? How do we defend against it? And that's one of those things that would be a slippery slope, as we say in the legal community. Because just imagine, I heard one podcaster say, one day, you guys, when President AOC is in office and she decides that who's part of X, Y, and Z groups are all of a sudden domestic terrorists and they go round them up, you guys will be upset. So when the pendulum swings, everyone will be upset. So they have to be careful about what kind of precedents they're setting. And I think that people on both sides of the aisle are starting to see that.
Well, I think I'll throw a little theory out to Professor Riedel about why I think we've protected hate speech in this country, is because much of this country was formed under racist tendencies. You know, if you look at the history of slavery, the people on top were saying all those racist things.
Exactly.
Right? They were marching. They were burning people. They were doing all that stuff. And when you have a society filled with mean people who think mean things, it gets protected. Anyway, I want to.
I just want to add. I think this is a serious threat. You know, Trump makes policy based on his personal grievances. And remember, about a week ago, he was announcing the great success of having troops on the street in Washington, D.C., and therefore more people could go out to dinner. It was actually the opposite. Restaurant visits were down, but Trump grabbed some of his cabinet. They went to dinner. While they were in the restaurant, they were confronted by peace activists who were yelling things at him about the genocide in Gaza. And Trump's now saying, you know, he went to the restaurant and people yelled at him, and those are the people that should be arrested, even. And his White House counsel was actually on CNN talking about that specific situation. So I think we are going to see people who are participating in peaceful protest being targeted, especially if they happen to get close to the president. But on a lighter note, Sienna's comment about a little Thomas and a dash of a little Alito sounds like a very bad recipe for a cocktail.
But it would probably cost too much anyway, a high-class restaurant.
And very quickly, Judith, you're 100% correct. If those people that made those comments to President Trump were immigrants or foreign nationals, they would have been probably picked up right away.
Right.
It's the question of whether or not it extends to the other persons, that other people that... I think everyone should be protected, of course, but whether or not the Supreme Court will protect everybody, that's the question.
I was shocked they weren't arrested, quite frankly, because if you look at that video, they got pretty close to the president in that restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see some of the Secret Service, all right, time to go. You know, but I was surprised they weren't arrested. You could get that close to the president of the United States.
I'm sure they know who they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the great thing about America. You can run around and yell anything at anyone. And
well,
unless you are, you know, a
crowded
public
theater
threat. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are reasonable limits, and you can't, you know, suggest you can't undertake violence, of course. But you can, any one of us can go into a swanky D.C. restaurant and yell anything we want. That's the beauty of this country, except you can't yell fire, or you can't provoke violence. But that's not what these protesters were doing.
No, and there was a whole group of them out on the street, and I saw one of them filming, and they turned to the right, and you got a view of all the protesters, and every one of them had their hand raised in the air with their middle finger up. So you can certainly do and say anything. Well, you know, I want to throw this out because it's a letter that came in, and it came a little after our discussion when you were bringing up Governor Hochul and climate change, Judith. And here you go. Get ready, man. Here comes a shot.
Okay.
You ready? From
I'm
William.
Ready.
Today's panel is disappointed with Governor Hochul's evolving stance on climate policy in New York State. What does the panel want? Climate policy from Governor Stefanik?
Please.
P-U-H-L-E-A-S-E. Please.
We live in a democracy where you can have debates on policy issues and not always be backed in a corner and saying, oh, what do you want, you know, a Republican elected? Everyone should feel free to look at the environmental policies of any administration, say what they think, and not feel that they're contributing to electing at least Stefanik. That's just such an intellectually lazy comment.
But it is
William.
It is also a political calculation, isn't it? I mean, we don't
so
know.
What are we, yeah, are we supposed to, not to be difficult with you, but are we not supposed to speak out on any issue for the next year?
No,
and
absolutely.
Half?
But I'm thinking of, you know, back in that election where the Bernie bros sat on their hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think, you know, building nuclear power plants is a bad idea, and it's probably something that Stefanik and Hochul agree on. So no risk there.
All right. It is a blue state after all. But, you know, things have happened.
I'm gonna back up Judith on this. It's like we are unfortunately at the point where people just blindly associate themselves with their chosen political party and go along with whatever comes from the political, rather than us actually being involved in the actual policy debate.
Well,
so,
Professor, that is something I've been thinking about. Is this a real problem? Now, look what's happened with the two-party system in this country. We are all Americans. And yet we'd rather cling to a label than talk to each other. Anyone?
I mean, isn't this kind of like what we were talking about earlier with the vaccinations? Like, it made it easier, right? You assume your party is aligned with what you want. And so, like, you don't have to do as much work. You don't have to research the issues. Everyone in the party, we're all aligned, right? It's the easy way to
especially
do things.
Especially the Republican Party.
Exactly. So we all just get into line behind where we're supposed to be without questioning someone or their nuances on that politics, because it makes it easier for us to, like, forget about politics and go about our day. Make your claim. Say which one you're part of and move on with your day. You can just function because, you know, once you say what you're a part of, you're aligned with everything. And now we're being called to the carpet. Now we have to be more nuanced. Now everyone has to know about more issues. We have to be more informed because the parties are askew. They are all over, you know what I mean? Like, and specifically. And so I think that's what it was. It was a lazy response. It is, right? It's easy to say which one you're part of. I'll be there to vote that day.
I'm gonna go ahead and say that I think the two-party system is at the heart of the problem. Two-party systems, generally, wherever you look, divide societies because you ask, are you here or are you there, in the left or on the right?
Yeah.
Multi-party systems. Now, I've grown up in a multi-party system. There's nobody who says, I'm a SPDer. I'm a Green Partier. It's like there are more political parties. There is more policy debates, and people are invited to vote based on policy interests rather than party affiliation.
I have to interrupt. Guess what? We have to go over to a break. We've got some news to do. We'll be back. I want you to think about that two-party system. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after the news.